proving a conspiracy can be a real head scratcher, you know, especially when you've got so many people involved and it goes on for years and years. It's like, where do you even start? Today, we're going to tackle a case that really dives into that. United States v. Borelli.
This one's from 1964, Second Circuit. It's all about a drug trafficking operation. And get this, it supposedly ran for almost a whole decade, from the 50s into the 60s.
Wow, that's a long time. So, like, what kind of operation are we talking about here? Give us the details.
Well, think importers, suppliers, distributors, the whole shebang. A whole network of people allegedly moving heroin. The big question the court had to figure out was this one massive conspiracy, or were there a bunch of smaller ones all happening separately?
I bet that makes a huge difference legally, right? One big conspiracy versus many smaller ones.
Absolutely. Because then you've got to think about each person's role and how long they were involved. Like, take this example. In 1950, you've got a guy named Ronaldo moving heroin for Rosario Mogadero.
Okay, so we're starting in 1950 with these two.
Got it. Right. But then fast forward to 1958, and a new guy named Castilla pops up. And here's the kicker. Some of these guys never even met each other.
So how can you say they were all in on the same scheme if they didn't even know each other? That doesn't seem fair.
Well, that's exactly what the courts had to grapple with. Plus, you've got the whole timeline thing to consider. The indictment didn't come down until 1962. So for the guys who supposedly stopped being involved way before that, what about the statute of limitations? You know, can you really hold someone responsible for something they did years ago if they weren't part of it anymore?
Right. That makes sense. You can't just keep charging people forever, right? So what happened? How did the courts handle this?
Well, at the trial level, they basically said, yep, it's all one big conspiracy. Everyone's guilty. But then the Second Circuit steps in and says, hold on, not so fast. They overturned those convictions.
What made them change their mind? I mean, it sounds like a pretty clear-cut case. Drug trafficking, lots of people, going on for years.
The problem was with how the jury was told to look at the case. The Second Circuit said the judge didn't do a good enough job explaining the difference between one big conspiracy and several smaller ones.
Oh, I see. So the jury might have thought everyone was part of the same plan, even if they weren't.
Exactly. And that's a huge problem when it comes to fairness, what we lawyers call due process. You can't just lump everyone together and say they're all guilty of the same grand scheme if some of them only played a small part or were only involved for a short time.
Yeah, that wouldn't be fair at all. So how did the Second Circuit fix this? What did they say about how to tell if it's one big conspiracy or many little ones?
That's where Judge Shrenley comes in. He wrote the opinion for the Second Circuit, and he really focused on this idea of agreement.
Agreement, like they all had to agree to be part of this big plan.
Yeah, basically. Judge Shrenley said it's not enough to just have a bunch of people doing illegal stuff. For it to be a conspiracy, they have to be working together, intentionally, with a common goal in mind. He even quoted another famous judge, Learned at Hand, who said each person has to be actively involved in pushing the whole scheme forward.
That makes sense. You can't just punish someone for being in the wrong place at the wrong time. So how do you prove that everyone agreed to the same plan, especially if some of them never even met?
Well, the court talked about this idea of a chain versus a spoke. Mm-hmm. Think of it like this. In a chain, every link is connected directly to the next one, right? They're all part of the same continuous thing. But in a wheel, you have a central hub, and the spokes all connect to that hub, but not necessarily to each other.
Okay, I get the analogy. So in a chain conspiracy, everyone knows everyone and is working directly together. But in a spoke conspiracy, they might only know the central person and not the others involved.
You got it. But here's the thing. The court said Borelli wasn't so simple. It wasn't a perfect chain or a perfect spoke. It changed over time. Different people came and went, the source of the drugs probably changed, and the connections between everyone weren't always clear.
So how did they decide if it was one big conspiracy or not?
They had to look at each person individually. Like, take Castilla, the guy who came in later. He might have been part of a totally different agreement than the guys from 1950. Different suppliers, different distributors, maybe even a slightly different goal. Even if it was still all about heroin, his understanding of the whole thing might have been way more limited.
So he might not have been guilty of the same conspiracy as the original guys.
Exactly. And that ties back into the statute of limitations issue. If he joined after 1957, then he couldn't be held responsible for anything that happened before that. The jury needed to be told how to figure that out for each person, not just treat them all the same.
So what are the big lessons from Borelli? Why is this case still important today?
First off, it shows how crucial jury instructions are. The judge can't just assume there's one big conspiracy. They have to explain to the jury how to figure out if that's true for each person, based on what they did and what they knew.
That makes sense. The jury needs the right information to make a fair decision.
And secondly, it highlights that you can't just lump everyone together in a conspiracy case. You have to look at each person's role, their knowledge, and when they were involved. You can't just say, you're all part of this, so you're all guilty.
Right. That wouldn't be fair.
And this isn't just some old case that doesn't matter anymore. These principles are still important today, especially with all the complex criminal stuff going on.
Like what? Give us some examples.
Well, think about big drug cartels. They have people all over the world, and the players are constantly changing. Or those complicated financial crimes that go on for years, with different people coming in and out of the picture.
So Burley gives us a framework for figuring out who's really responsible in those kinds of situations.
Exactly. It all comes down to agreement. You have to prove that each person intentionally joined the plan and was actively helping it succeed. Just being in the same general area or knowing some of the people involved isn't enough.
So for our listeners out there, think about this. If you were a judge in a conspiracy case, how would you explain to the jury how to tell if it's one big conspiracy or several smaller ones? What are the key things they need to look at to make sure everyone is treated fairly?
And hey, if you find that interesting, we can delve deeper into related legal concepts like Pinkerton liability in a future episode. This looks at how much one person in a conspiracy can be held responsible for the actions of the others, even if they weren't directly involved. It's all part of this constantly evolving area of law, and it really makes you think about how we determine who's responsible for what in these complex criminal schemes.
It definitely gives you a lot to think about. Until next time.